Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, I'm Kirk Migu, host of Politics and Polemics on the New Books Network. I also host my own podcast called Independent Thought and Freedom, where I interview some of the most interesting people from around the world who are shaking up politics, economics, society, and ideas. You can find it in the iTunes Store or on any one of your favorite podcast providers. You can also subscribe to my YouTube channel. Also, are you an academic that wants to get heard nationally? Check out my free training on 3 steps how to use your intellectual authority to become a media personality at becomeapublicintellectual.com. That's becomeapublicintellectual.com. You can find the links below. And now, on to this week's episode. Hello. Today, my guest is Phil Harvey, co-author with Lisa Conyers of Welfare for the Rich, How Your Tax Dollars End Up in Millionaires' Pockets and What You Can Do About It, published in 2020. Welcome, Phil.
My pleasure to be here. Thanks.
Yeah, well, congratulations on the book. It's got a lot of advanced praise, and it's very interesting. All the sort of examples and research that you've put together here. I saw you had it's a blog post. I saw it online, but it may have been in print since 2017, where you were talking about researching this book. Did it actually take that long to do the research?
Well, I have found that writing a book, even with a co-author who's done a great deal of the work on it, takes a long time. I'm not very good at deadlines and doing things quickly, as it turns out. So I would say, yes, it's been 3 years in the making. The book is actually not due out until August 5, but it's a pleasure to be discussing it now since the book is finished. And we're just putting the finishing touches on the cover and a few things like that. But it will be available very soon.
Okay, great. Well, why don't we start off with the concept of welfare for the rich? So what you mean by it and why it's important?
Well, the idea that the government at federal, state, and even local level should take taxpayer money from ordinary workers and middle-class taxpayers and turn it over in the form of subsidies, cash payments, various breaks, monetary breaks of various kinds, to wealthy corporations and individuals is an idea that I don't think anybody really supports. The idea that you take from those who have less and give to those who have more is simply nonsensical. But that is going on, in fact, all of the time now, a result of very effective lobbying in many cases by large corporations and by individual interests. Our feeling is that people on both sides of the aisle, and this is pretty much a bipartisan issue, it seems to me, Robin Hood in reverse, if you will, taking taxpayer money and turning it over to millionaires and billionaires. Indeed, in the case of agricultural payments, there are many, many examples of taxpayer payments under the Farm Bill being made to billionaires, really rich people, who happen to own a few acres of farmland. Many of them don't farm. They don't live on their farms. My favorite story in the farming payments ripoff is the Disney ploy. The Disney Corporation gets enormous subsidies in both Florida and Southern California, as you might expect, but they're also getting some agricultural money because they put a few cows out to pasture on a piece of their property in Florida. So they're in, if, as far as the government subsidy machine is concerned, they're in the farming business. So they soak up some of that money as well. And of course, Disney is, as you know, is a very, very wealthy corporation.
Yeah. And I know music stars like Bruce, I think Bruce Springsteen and Bon Jovi and very wealthy individuals do stuff like that all the time as well, don't they?
Sure. And there, of course, are people in the business of helping other people do that. I mean, there are several lawyers, one who's gotten quite wealthy in the process, who form agricultural partnerships of various kinds. Agricultural payments are normally limited to people whose income is $900,000 a year or less, not exactly penury. If family members, one's spouse, one's brother-in-law, one's cousin, and a few others can get together in a partnership, their income limitations don't stop payments of many, many, many millions of dollars going to the partnership, which of course gives all of those people opportunity to participate in the largesse. It's simply unexcusable.
Was there anything that sort of drove you to write the book? Is there a story behind, you know, something that made you say, listen, I've just got to document this,
Well, there were several things. One is in 2016, Lisa and I wrote a book called The Human Cost of Welfare. We examined the entire welfare program. That is the program that really is designed for low-income people, a means-tested program that includes things like food stamps and the earned income tax credit and a number of others. And in the process of researching and writing that book, we were very distressed to learn that in combination, our welfare programs are really failing the people they need to help. In the sense that they are not doing anything to get people on welfare into work. We talked to one fellow who was very eloquent on the subject. He said, I go to the welfare office to get my food stamp cards updated, and all the posters on the wall are about other welfare programs. He said, they should post jobs. What we want is jobs. We want to work. And get off of welfare. But the welfare system is designed to perpetuate itself and to expand. And it is very, very poor at getting people back to work so that they won't need the welfare any longer and so that they can hold their heads up and work and live with some dignity and self-respect. It's just very, very bad at that, and the rules tend to make it awkward and difficult to get off the welfare programs and into work, because the way the numbers fall out, that sometimes means, in fact, it often means taking a cut in income. So we were very distressed to learn the details of the existing welfare program, and in the process said, well, why in the face of this is so much not, it's not called welfare, of course, but subsidies and payments being made to wealthy people and wealthy corporations that could be used to provide jobs. The one welfare-oriented program that does work reasonably well is the earned income tax credit, which rewards people for work, makes working tops up people's earned income, and that could be greatly expanded in our view, especially if we stopped the hundreds, literally hundreds of billions of dollars being paid every year to parties that do not need and do not deserve to get those payments.
Yeah, this is a an interesting thing I want to explore with you, which is basically your background, because a lot of people writing on this, especially from an academic perspective, and a lot of our audience is, you know, grad students and professors, and they usually come at it from a left-wing perspective, and you know, in the media. You know, you have people like Robert Reich, you have Anand Giridharadas, who's been talking about the billionaire class, and you have that side, which I think people are pretty well familiar with. That's the kind of dominant discourse. And then you have the kind of, I suppose, the libertarian, the Fox News, the right-wing side with, Steve Bannon and Sarah Palin before talking about crony capitalism, and you had the Tea Party, and to a large extent the Trump movement is has been tied into that, although in practice it's been very murky. Your ideological perspective, where is that? And I'd like you to bring in some of your personal history, you know, your business, your philanthropy, because I find that very interesting, because your personal history sort of cuts across ideological lines in a lot of ways, I think.
Well, I think that is correct. Give you a very quick summary. As a young man, I did 5 years with the relief organization CARE in India back in the 60s. From there, and in connection with that job, I got into the family planning business, convinced that the most useful thing we could do for people in developing countries was to provide easy and convenient access to contraceptives and contraceptive services. So I founded an organization called VKT International, which today is reaching something like 46 million couples in 25 or 30 countries, led by a really superb guy named Chris Purdy. So that is ongoing. More relevant to the book is the DKT Liberty Project. I've dumped around on some of these things over the years. Mm-hmm. And that project is focused on the United States, and it's focused on civil liberties. We have been very active, for example, in the war on drugs, because, in my opinion, the war on drugs has been the worst thing to happen to civil liberties and civil rights in this country since the days of Joseph McCarthy. Devastating impact, particularly on minorities, but also on everyone who gets caught up in the war on drugs. So we've done a good deal of work in that area. We have worked on the issues of civil asset forfeiture, which is a very strange and inexcusable arrangement in American law that allows the police to take property from people on the mere suspicion that it may have been involved in something illegal. And they often keep the property, even if they never indict or even accuse the owning party of having done anything illegal or even wrong. So we have done some work in that area to help get their property back when it's been inappropriately seized.
So in a lot of ways, I mean, you have this sort of sense of justice and injustice, but you're not coming from the sort of normal, expected sort of left-wing discourse on that topic. Am I right?
Yes, I'm a libertarian, and basically I think the libertarian principles have it right. That is to say, government should stay out of our bedrooms, and there we agree with the liberals. And the government should also stay out of our boardrooms, and there we tend to agree with the conservatives. That is, the role of the federal government should be defined and limited and transparent, while recognizing, of course, that governments have certain functions that they must undertake and maintain. But in today's world, loaded with regulations and rules and requirements and paperwork, a great deal of which slows down economic development. And the kinds of policies that go into welfare for the rich, subsidizing coal, for example. Now, there's a really smart move. We're trying to get away from loading up the atmosphere with carbon and federal government, partly at Trump's urging, but it had been going on before Trump, is turning over millions of dollars to try to keep coal plants working when we'd all be better off at least switching to natural gas, which is now cheaper. That process is ongoing, and that's a good thing. But retrograde tendencies of the federal government, which has a hard time not going on doing things that it's been doing, even if they're very tends to keep those kinds of things going.
Yeah. But now, you know, what would be, let's say, the coal industry, for example, that you gave the example, the specific example for. You know, what are the arguments in favor of welfare for the rich in that case?
Well, in that case, the argument, particularly as put forward by Trump, are jobs. There are a lot of people, mostly men, who have worked traditionally in coal mines. It has been generally well paid work, but it is also very dangerous work, or it can be dangerous. Anyway, the justification is normally the fact that we need the jobs and we need the energy. But energy sources now are much more diversified, don't really need, and are not, in fact, using a great deal of energy from coal, although it's still significant. And it's very significant in China and India, and is therefore a climate change contributor, especially in those countries. But that's the basic rationale. The jobs are increasing.
So would you'd concede that there is some rationale for it? But what, that it's sort of gotten out of hand, it's being abused. What would your counter be then to that argument, which sounds reasonable?
Well, my counter to it is that the government should stop subsidizing all energy. The creation of energy is a very profitable business. Our energy companies, our oil firms, oil companies, natural gas companies and so on are among the most profitable companies in the American economy. They do not need to be subsidized. They should not be subsidized. Subsidization distorts the market. It interferes with honest competition. It does not produce more of anything, generally speaking, except in the very short run. No more subsidies in the energy business. And I would go further than that and say no more subsidies in agriculture, which tends to be way over subsidized as well. Particularly, as I mentioned earlier, for parties who are not even in the farming business. Mm-hmm. So my overall and the overall tenor of the book is to kill these bad subsidies quick. This will not cost anything. Indeed, it will be a net revenue gainer for the government and for the taxpayer. And it's one of the few things that we can do that doesn't cost anything that's going to make inequality, for example, income and wealth inequality, better simply by stopping the subsidization of wealthy parties.
Well, let's get into some of the details, which really makes up the bulk of your book, because I think a lot of times when you get into the sort of abstract arguments on one side or the other, you know, it seems, you know, reasonable, but when you get to some of the examples that you dig up here, it's quite amazing and absurd when you see what actually goes on with this stuff. I mean, you talk about farmers and tariffs and stadiums and movies, entertainment, zoning, regulations, big tech, a lot of different areas. Now, are there any, you know, instead of, I mean, we obviously want people to buy a book to read it, but would you say that there are any examples in the book that you uncovered that even for you was like totally surprising and shocking?
Well, the one small matter I mentioned, which is Disney putting a few cows on a stretch of their own property in order to collect agricultural subsidies, I was both shocked and amused by. The sugar program is probably one of the most egregious examples because the sugar program that subsidizes sugar farmers in the United States, sugar growers in the United States, has been attacked over and over and over again by reporters and book writers and filmmakers, and yet it goes on and on and on. Basically, there's a series of price guarantees by the government, strict limits on any short sugar that can be imported from another country, and quotas for those few countries that we do allow to send sugar in. And the result is that sugar in the United States costs double what it costs anywhere else in an open market in the world. This is inexcusable. The result is that sugar barons like Pepe Fanjul and his brother in Florida are raking in hundreds of millions of dollars every year. They are sugar growers in Florida, and without any justification. The thing that makes the sugar program even worse is that you don't have to have enough of an income even to pay income taxes to be paying for it. Everybody who buys commercial food, whether it's pies or bread or ketchup, anything that contains sugar, is paying more for it than they should be, and in effect is putting their extra pennies on those food products into the Fanjul's pockets every year. It's utterly unjustifiable on legal, moral, ethical grounds, and yet it goes on. And the number of attempts that have been made in Congress to correct this have all failed, because the sugar lobbies are very, very good at lobbying.
Yeah, yeah. And about how much, do you have an idea about how much actually goes to the sugar industry as a result of the lobbying?
I don't have a figure off the top of my head, but it's in the tens or hundreds of billions of dollars. I mean, it's big business.
Really? So that big? Yeah. Wow. And I mean, there are some, individuals you have mentioned, too, like Elon Musk, for example, who's, considered, this sort of amazing visionary entrepreneur, but you've called him out for a long time, with Tesla and Solar City and SpaceX, receiving billions of dollars in public support, and a lot of these big tech people that project themselves as these models of entrepreneurship, when you look behind it, there's something else. Do you want to elaborate on some of that for us?
Well, Musk is an interesting case. He's so effective at getting state governments in particular to compete for his business that states are kind of coming to him and offering him tax breaks if he'll locate in their neighborhoods. As a result, he has been able to raise hundreds of millions, probably billions of dollars in subsidies for his various enterprises. I don't question the fact that he's an enormously imaginative and successful entrepreneur, but he should stop asking taxpayers around the country to subsidize his efforts. He's a multi-billionaire himself. He doesn't need support and payments from ordinary tax-paying citizens, but he keeps getting it over and over and over again. That should simply stop. The same state governments that subsidize his enterprises, you mentioned films, another interesting example, a lot of state governments offer major tax breaks and other forms of incentives to film companies if they'll come make their films in the state at issue. That has gotten to be very expensive in terms of lost revenue to the states, and some of them are backing away from it. But the idea that Montana's taxpayers should be paying to film companies that they know nothing about and that don't really need their support is just another example of a rather weird way that money moves from taxpayers to wealthy parties.
Yeah, yeah. And it's one thing I find interesting about this is that I suppose on both sides, we talked a little bit about, the opposition to it comes from both the right and the left. But I think, if you step back, it's the whole genesis of it, of this redistribution from the poor to the rich, also is bipartisan, from the right to the left. What do you think? Do you think that's a coincidence? Do you think it's a conspiracy? Do you think it's a kind of racket inherent in all government, because there are people who sort of defend the act of lobbying itself and as part of the democratic process, and I suppose that's kind of a liberal thing if I want to pin it ideological somewhere. Then there's a kind of socialist who say, listen, we need economic diversification, we need revitalization, or the market is irrational, so we need to provide incentives here or whatever that they have. And then I suppose there's just greedy lobbyists. I don't know if I would call that right-wing ideology, but certainly it's, business people just looking for their own interests and their own pockets in whatever way they can. So you have this. Do you see any particular driving force among all these, all these actors trying to get people's tax dollars and government subsidies?
Well, in terms of ideology, the difference, I think, lies in the distinction between the ideology and the actual on-the-ground cases. In other words, I think both liberals and conservatives are opposed to crony capitalism in general, that is, capitalist-oriented corporations who have connections in high places of getting favors from the government. As a general process, most conservatives will say that's wrong, and virtually all liberals will say that's wrong. But when it comes to individual cases, then it depends on whose ox is gored. And the very conservatives, and in some cases liberals, who oppose the idea will say, well, now, wait a minute, my Uncle Joe works in that field. And it's they need their subsidies, because without their subsidies, some of them would go out of business. That's sometimes true, by the way. Capitalism is a process of creative destruction, as one scholar has cogently remarked, and some businesses do and have to go out of business. But the thought of losing jobs gets everybody in a great deal of heat and distress. So the difference comes down to individual cases, and the farmers will tell you, as they told us when we were researching the book, that those agricultural subsidies are absolutely essential, and they'll come up with a few cases where they are essential or at least very useful, and ignore the 90% of the cases where they're unneeded and unjustified. But it's very, very easy to passionately defend a subsidy if you are part of what is getting subsidized. And that is one way that these subsidy programs get perpetuated. That and the fact that the agricultural interests, for example, are very, very well connected in Congress.
Right. So in a way, they're able to use stories and cases that perhaps are deserving of, it's weird to say, but deserving of welfare for the rich, because I suppose ultimately it's supposed to go back to the community or the state or jobs and ordinary people. I suppose it's that kind of circuitous route. But so while they make that justification, then I guess people slip through unnoticed and end up receiving 90% of the subsidies. It's that kind of process you see going on?
Yes, and you mentioned the jobs rationale, and that one is very, very common, particularly when a state government agrees to provide a tax holiday, property tax holiday, typically, may be worth hundreds of millions of dollars to a company for locating there. And the company, in return, will normally promise to create 150 or 500 or a couple of thousand jobs. And those jobs frequently simply don't materialize. Even when they do materialize, we find and published a number of cases in the book where the cost per job was something like $600,000. In other words, in terms of an investment for job creation, these are terrible and unjustified. So that is a very common pattern. And it generally fails.
Yeah, and because it's quite amazing to think about it that as you say, everybody's against it, right? I mean, theoretically, there's no justification for it, morally, and whether you're on the right, whether you're on the left, but yet it continues, to grow. And I suppose it's the way that they can sort of use, you know, the few deserving cases as justification for, you know, what really turns out to be a kind of huge racket when you sort of to dig beneath the surface. And I think, your research would have started way before the coronavirus, of course. And, but I think the coronavirus bill sort of illustrates that, because, you know, that's been called, you know, the largest upward transfer of wealth in history. I don't know the figures exactly, but I've heard critics talk about that, you know, what was supposed to help ordinary people has ended up being these massive transfers to the wealthy. And do you have any comments on that?
Well, there's a lot of truth in that, and it's part of a long-term pattern. The payroll protection program, for example, which was originally a $360-some billion a part of the COVID-19 relief package, was designed specifically to help small businesses. They were defined as businesses with fewer than 500 employees. And some of that has actually gone to small businesses. I will concede that up front. But a great deal of it has gone to chain corporations of restaurants and hotels that have thousands of employees, because Congress decided that they should be accepted. There are a large number of such recipients who don't need that money, and indeed a few of them have been so embarrassed about accepting a government bailout money that they have returned it, which indicates definitely a lack of need and recipients being among the most wealthy. I mean, this is not unexpected. Somehow, the people with connections always end up doing better than the ordinary hardware store or a local restaurant. And it's sad. It is quite sad, and it also will have backlash, I'm afraid, because if the COVID-19 relief package, which is huge, somewhere in the vicinity of $3 trillion now, is seen as bailing out big business the way we did with banks in 2008, and letting the small guys go, as we did in 2008, that is, the small banks all suffered while the big banks raked it in. If this program is seen the same way as helping the big hotel chains and restaurant chains and other wealthy businesses and leaving local businesses and small businesses high and dry, it will further solidify people's low opinion of the government.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and I mean, one important thing about your book too is that it's not just a litany of complaints and outrages, and you also really talk about solutions and about trying to fight this and fix this. Could you elaborate on that for us, please?
Well, it's tough. The First Amendment to the Constitution guarantees the right to lobby, or we, the people, corporations, anyone, can appear before government and make its claims. Therefore, lobbying is here to stay. and not all of it is bad. I mean, there's no reason why people with a legitimate interest shouldn't talk to their congressman or senator to correct wrongs that need to be corrected. But to get at some of the things we have been talking about this morning, one, I think, most productively turns to the organizations that are working on this, the organizations that work toward tax fairness in the tax laws, the organizations that one called POGO stands for something I can't remember right now, that watchdogs government expenditures to see that we're not paying $2,000 for toilet seats and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Working with and supporting those organizations, which we list in the last chapter of the book, with their contact information, I think is the best hope. So is community activism. I think that getting involved with groups in your own community and running as much of your lives in the community as you can, as opposed to waiting for Washington to say something this way or that way, is healthy on many, many levels. It takes on some of the things that human beings are best at, which is taking care of each other, people we know, people we interact with. That also is very helpful because it makes the lobbying effort by the big boys simply irrelevant or less relevant. All of those things, I think, are helpful. But I'm not at all optimistic about altering the influence that major groups and corporations, including some nonprofits, by the way. Mm-hmm. The AARP is a very, very active lobbyist, for example, on behalf of their members, in one respect, perfectly appropriate. But the extent of lobbying activity and the extent to which bad programs are maintained, again, usually on the observation that ending them might cost jobs, I think is going to go on. I don't think we can do a great deal about it, although, like liberty in general, we have to keep trying.
Yeah. You know, this is interesting because, the rise of populism throughout the world, in the United States and elsewhere, I think it's a fascinating and very important phenomenon. And it's been across both the right and the left. I mean, so you had things like Occupy Wall Street, for example. You personally, identified yourself as a libertarian, and, it doesn't necessarily put you on the right, although there would be some things that you would be sympathetic for in, I suppose the Republican Party, I'm guessing. And I don't know, maybe the Democrat Party as well. Like, for instance, what would be your opinion of, let's say, the Occupy Wall Street movement when that happened, when people were outraged at the subsidies that the banks were getting while people were being put out of their homes and stuff. What, that is a type of activism. Is that something that you think is effective or that you have sympathy with? I'm curious.
Well, I'm certainly sympathetic with anybody who wishes to express their views in groups or by themselves or any other way. I mean, Occupy Wall Street consisted of people who had every right within the limits of not disrupting the movement of city life in New York, but every right to make their views known, to protest and to march and to camp out to the extent they followed the rules there. So I'm mm-hmm. I'm completely supportive of free speech issues of virtually any kind, as long as they don't lead to or perpetrate violence. I think that, one of the great things about this country, and one of the things that's going to get us through crises like the one we're in now, is a firm belief in the right of people to protest, firm belief in free speech, including speech we detest. A crucial component of any free country, that right should not be abrogated or trimmed in any way. And I think that there have been a few cases during the crisis of state governments trying to curtail protesters who are protesting the extent of the lockdowns. They should let them go. They should let them protest, as long as they're not endangering other people in the process. That is sacrosanct, as far as I'm concerned.
And it's interesting because, a lot of the Occupy Wall Street people, their solutions, I would imagine, you would be opposed to, because, a lot of communists and, outright communists and socialists and stuff there, which obviously would be against your libertarian principles. The Tea Party, I think, was motivated by a lot of the same kind of concerns, but expressed very differently and by a very different political demographic. But you had Occupy on the one hand, you had the Tea Party on the other. I think there was a lot of common ground, but practically they seemed poles apart. Is there a way that you see that this should be bridged or could be bridged? I'd like to hear your views on that, because the discontent is, as you say, across the political spectrum, but people remain divided in a lot of ways in their opposition to it.
Well, we're never going to get everybody happy. Kumbaya, and I see nothing wrong with that. A democracy is a country with different groups with different priorities, and I don't see any virtue in trying to get everybody together to sing on the same page. Let us have Occupy Wall Street. Let us have the Tea Party. They have not disrupted political life in this country irredeemably, in my view. At least that's my optimistic view at this point. So disagreement is fine. The only thing that we should not allow in connection with disagreement is violence.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, as we bring the interview to a close here, what message would you like to leave your readers with after they get through your book?
Well, certainly pay attention to the suggestions and recommendations in the last chapter, and talk it up. There is so much injustice involved in taking your money and mine and giving it to people who don't need it and don't deserve it, and are 100 times wealthier than you and I are. Talk it up. Give it some thought. And again, as I said, contact, if you are so inclined, some of the organizations that are working on these issues in Washington.
Great. I know you are a very active and busy person. Are there any other projects that you're working on right now?
The projects in the DKT Liberty Project, which has a pretty active website, are ongoing, and I will continue with that. And I continue to support the International Family Planning Group, DKT International.
Okay, great. Well, thanks so much for this interview. It's been very informative and enjoyable. And I encourage all our listeners to get your book. It's coming out in August, you said?
August 5, yes.
August 5th, right? Welfare for the rich, how your tax dollars end up in millionaires' pockets and what you can do about it. It's Phil Harvey, one of the co-authors. The other is Lisa Conyers. And so I really look forward to it, and I hope you have a great success with it. Thanks.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
That's all for Politics and Polemics this week. If you like this, remember to check out my other podcast, Independent Thought and Freedom, and subscribe to my YouTube channel. Also, if you are an academic and want to get heard nationally, check out my free training at becomeapublicintellectual.com. Thanks, and see you next week.